All right, well, let me go on and start the real meat of the day. And it's my pleasure to turn the floor over to Molly Holschlag, who's right to my right here. One of the things we're doing, as I mentioned before, is to try to become more accessible and to understand and to build a community with the developers and designers out there. And so we've asked Molly to organize a session of people from the outside of W3C, people who have not spent their lives working developing standards here at W3C, from designers and developers. Molly herself is an excellent candidate to do that, being an independent education and outreach expert. As she puts it, she translates the work that you do into language that the people out there actually developing and designing websites can use. So without further ado, I turn the microphone over to Molly.
Thank you very much. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes, good. How are you doing today? Good? Everybody's got a good night's sleep, feeling rested? Or the jet lag kicking in? Anyway, as Steve said, I'm Molly Holschlag, and that is a whole, not a half, schlag. Yes, thank you for the laugh. Appreciate laughter. Always good, yes. At any rate, I am very, very honored to be here today for the very reasons that Steve was just describing. I think that this particular event is an historic one for certain reasons. We see an incredible shift in the wind. I feel that for the last several years, we have noted in the industry at large an opening up of businesses, of organizations. Everything the web touches, it seems to force a paradigm shift upon. So if the web touches a corporation, that corporation must shift in order to change and accommodate the way that we now work. We work differently than the old and linear. We are now in a new and agile model and a new time of that nature. So one of the exciting things about being in that is that within the W3C, which has often been perceived, if not in fact, but in perception, as the ivory tower of the web, the insiders, right, who are creating the specifications for who? Perhaps the implementers, perhaps the designers, perhaps the authors. And there's been, again, a perceived disconnect between what the W3C has been doing over the years and what people really want, need, and are concerned about that are working on the ground. So I don't know why I have no VGA. Yes, I do, because somebody unplugged it. Let's see here. Hello, AV. How come I have no VGA? There we go. All righty. Thank you. Okay. So one of the things that I kind of looking at metaphorically what's going on is, I don't know if anybody here is familiar with Kabbalistic beliefs, but this particular, this is something that's interested me since I was very young. And this particular, this is a card from the tarot deck, which is the tower. So it kind of goes in with that perception of ivory tower. But what this particular card signifies, according at least to some of history's great psychologists such as Carl Jung and other people who have studied the archetypal visual ideologies that have been expressed via such such expressions as the Kabbalah, is that this is a passage and a time that occurs in people's or industrial history where a shift gets made, where something brings the wall down, something brings the ivory tower down. And while it looks dramatic and painful, and it is often, change is difficult, right? While it is often difficult to change, the ultimate message of this belief is that when we get through that process, we can begin to rebuild the foundation anew, and therefore much more strongly. Okay, so I think we're in a very fascinating time, and this is the time of opening. And a more wonderful time could not exist in the W3C for that to happen. And you're going to hear other people talk about that during the day, the opening of working groups and the openness and transparent process and how that can be of great advantage to the W3C and, of course, the people that it serves. So I'd like to introduce, actually I have the panelists that have joined me, that I'm very honored said yes, but various people from different walks of the web world, and I'll have them individually introduce themselves. So we'll start with Aaron there.
Hi, I'm Aaron Gustafson. I am a freelance designer developer. I have my own consulting company. I also do a lot of work through the Web Standards Project, so advocacy on your all's behalf. I'm also a member of the CSS 11, which is a group of individuals, designers and developers who are trying to help clarify some of the specs within CSS 3 to help look for ambiguities and that sort of thing. And I'm very excited to be here, and I'm very thankful that you all are interested in hearing outside perspectives on what we think of the W3C. And I'll be kind of coming from both a designer and developer perspective, but also from an educator perspective, because like Molly, I do a lot of training for corporations and a lot of public speaking, et cetera, at conferences telling people about CSS and about XHTML, JavaScript, and the like. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Aaron. We'll go to Patrick.
Hi, I'm Patrick Haney, and I'm a UI designer at Harvard University. And that's where I work on a lot of course and department websites throughout Harvard. I do most of the design, a lot of the XHTML and CSS development, so that's why I'm here.
Thanks, Patrick. And of course, me. We don't need to know more about me. Matthew?
My name is Matt. Apparently I can't press the green light well enough here.
There you go.
My name is Matthew Oliphant. I currently work at the MathWorks. I'm a usability specialist focused on the web. I do a lot of user community stuff as well. In my past, professional life has been mostly in large corporations doing design and usability work, focusing on web applications. And there we go. So if you didn't hear the first part, it was really great. And this last part, I'll just wrap it up with that. Thank you.
Thanks, Matthew. And Stephanie.
Okay, is this working now? All right. My name is Stephanie Troth. I work in a studio, a web interactive agency down in Montreal, Canada. There I head up a studio of architects, web developers, web designers, and we cater for helping companies establish their interactive strategy online and also help them to build their sites.
Thanks, everybody. Okay, so with that, what we decided to do is we sat down over the last month and we began to drill down into some ideas and thoughts and concerns that we had as working developers and designers and managers of real-world websites, many of them, many times, very large websites. And we came up with a number of questions that we are going to discuss here, offer some possible solutions to, and then, of course, open it up to the wider discussion here in the room via Q&A. Also, if this is a topic that interests you, let me also add that we will have time at the break to continue questions and answers, and we will also have a birds of a feather table up at lunch today. So if you're interested in continuing this conversation, then please, by all means, feel free to join us at coffee and at lunch, okay? So without further ado, what I'd like to do is talk to the panelists a bit about what the role of a specification, or what we call, or come to call standards, web standards, really is. I think some of the difficulty that we've seen, some of the gap that needs to be bridged is in what language comes out of W3C and what resources are actually needed by designers and developers. There's often a difference in language and the vocabulary that's used, and I think that many of the people here can address that. Anybody want to jump in on that?
I can jump in first. I mean, I think there are multiple things kind of working at work in terms of how the specs are interpreted by us in the real world. First of all, it comes down to knowing who your audience is and who it is exactly that you're writing the specifications for. A lot of times it seems like the specifications are written for the implementers, so the people who are making the browsers, which is great, but unfortunately, as we've seen in the past, certain ambiguities within the specs lead to different browsers doing different interpretations of CSS properties or only implementing certain elements and avoiding other elements, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's kind of one of the problems. The other problem is that from a developer perspective, trying to learn about CSS or trying to learn about XHTML, it becomes very difficult to try to grasp the language of what's going on because the word choices, the nomenclature, the ontology is not always immediately apparent, what exactly somebody is trying to express. And I imagine it can only get worse when English is not your native language. So, I mean, that's certainly one thing from our perspective that we see a lot is that, you know, people try and read the specs and either end up getting really frustrated or falling asleep.
Good bedtime reading. Stephanie, actually, you were bringing up a situation, and Matthew as well, in terms of this very issue over breakfast, where the language is a considerable concern.
One of the favorite, I guess, examples that I use is very simple. Those of us who work with CFS a lot, we know position relative, and we've worked out what it means. But if you come from a culture whereby the two words themselves are already out of context, and trying to learn CSS when English is not your native language is actually very difficult. And I do often get into conversations with folks who are saying, why is it so hard for other countries, non-English speaking countries, to pick out rep standards? And, well, there is no obvious barrier there in the language itself.
That's a very good point. Matthew, what you were talking a little bit about the nomenclature and made a little joke this morning. That was, I think, would be appropriate to perhaps retell.
I actually made a lot of jokes this morning, so.
I only heard one.
But I just wanted to back up a little bit. When we were having our discussions in preparing for this, one of the questions Molly asked us to answer was, how do web standards affect you? And my answer was, they don't really, because a lot of the people I work with barely know how to use them. The code they write is not that great. Ooh, thank you. And they're a couple steps beyond using font tags, but not that far, because they're developers who didn't grow up in web world. So they're struggling with things as well.
So I think that's a very unfortunately very common issue. It was interesting to me that you were talking about words and ontologies, and Matthew quipped over breakfast, who's like, you know, in the last sentence, Molly, you just said seven words that I don't understand.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, herein, I thought, was a very good metaphor for some of the disconnect that exists.
So, in talking with the panelists here in preparation for this, they have used a lot of words that I'm not really used to using, because I'm not really involved with the technical aspect of the web as much. I know enough to talk to developers. I know enough to know what good code looks like and bad code looks like. But I don't really use that kind of language. So I approach a lot of this from, obviously from a usability standpoint, but really from a business standpoint, and how to implement this and get and negotiate with people to do things properly. So the different language barriers that exist within the different groups that have to deal with standards is something that I have to work with every day, and it's one of the things that is always a challenge.
So then you would have to say that standards do affect your life, and they do affect your work life.
Standards absolutely do affect me. Yeah, it's just, it seems sometimes that they are non-existent.
One thing I'd like to add that I just kind of popped into my head as Matthew was talking is that the language really does have a cost, because by developers not being able to actually understand the specs, that takes them longer to actually understand what it is that they're supposed to be doing with them, and then that ends up costing their companies more money, or they have to have more training and that sort of stuff. So the lack of clarity in the spec from a developer's perspective ends up costing their employer or themselves, if they're self-employed, more money. And that's not a good thing.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. Patrick, do you have any issues here that you'd like to discuss in terms of what specifications are and the role they play at Harvard?
Well, I find myself often in the boat that Matthew's in, where I'm coming from more of a design perspective and not much of a development perspective. And so technical words, like he said, there's a lot of words said this morning that I don't hear very often, such as intrinsic. So nomenclature, for example. So, I mean, I work with the developers that I work with pretty closely, but I don't really have to worry too much about that sort of thing. So sometimes I find myself getting lost in a spec or trying to understand things a little bit more than I really would like to just understand it and get to my job. So
I'm in a slightly different position.
They're having trouble hearing somebody. Is it? They're having trouble hearing me? That may be a first.
That's definitely a first.
Uh-huh. Oh, no, I'm wired. They need to up the volume is what they need to do. Thank you. Is that good? I'm so sorry. Thank you, everybody, for that. Stephanie?
No, I just have to remember what I was trying to say. I'm in a slightly different position in that I do have a developer.
Can't hear you either.
You can't hear me either, and I'm about
as our green light is on.
Our green light is on. I'm about to lick the mic. Well,
that's the way to start the day.
Right. Is this any better? No?
Can you get more volume on that, please?
Is this one working?
There we go. Yeah. There we go.
No, I really have to remember what I was trying to say. I'm in a slightly different position in that I am able to read specifications and implement them because I do come from a development background. But at the same time, I have a bunch of junior developers I have to help train. And the cost is there as well, not because that, not in the training itself, but also just for them to reach the level whereby we want to achieve. So for example, let's say we make web standards or complying or valid code as part of a quality product that we produce. The cost that goes into that, who pays for it? Is it the company? Is it the client? That becomes that is actually a discouraging factor for us. And it takes a lot of guts and a lot of pressure to push management, for example, to say, you need to get this out there. Things have to be valid. Things have to be this. Things have to be accessible. But the justification basis for that almost doesn't exist.
Yeah, it's a huge struggle, I know, from my own experience, where you have a situation like, let's say, at a big company where somebody does want to move things forward, and they have to become internal evangelists, which is probably, in my opinion, one of the hardest jobs. Being an external evangelist, such as myself or people like with the Web Standards Project, is actually the easier job because we can say what we want. We're not necessarily risking our jobs. But I've seen so many people be in a position to move standards forward, and even people in this room that I've heard this from, where that agenda has harmed them in their work. Okay, so I think it becomes a very important thing to take a look at that and see how we can better articulate together the value, the core value of not just the idealistic value, but the core value as it comes down to the bottom line for companies to adopt better practices via specifications. So this is really a big concern worldwide. And so I definitely feel the pain that Stephanie is describing as I go into different companies and see that happening as well.
One of the things to build off of what Stephanie said, getting management buy-in in a corporate world for something that they don't understand is often very difficult. So in some ways, these standards and specifications are the management in these corporations that I have experience with. They're an audience member of the standards and specifications that get produced. They may be not the primary target that you want to reach, but there's someone who writes the check that says, yes, this can continue, yes, we think this is important, and typically they're only willing to do that when they understand what they're signing for. And when you leave it to someone like me who doesn't have this language yet, but who is very good at translating, because that my life is spent in between business people and developers, so I get good at translating. It becomes a challenge, but I would like some help.
Yeah, I think again it goes back to that articulation of ROI. We forget when we're building specifications that this turns into real money, real human resources, real issues for businesses. Let's move on to the next question so we can move along. One of the things that we all thought of was that there were concerns about where competition occurs, that maybe there's a little bit of incorrect perception of where people are competing in terms of the implementation world. Something that I talk about a great deal is I like to talk about how standards at the W3C really are de facto standards. And the fact that, for example, if you're buying a car, right, you go out to buy an automobile here in the United States, you have a warranty by that company that a certain standard of safety has been addressed. Now, you can, as that company, determine what features to then compete on, right? Whether you're competing on a feature set such as style, look of the car, family, sporty, all of those types of things. But and you can also then further expand upon your safety. But you all have to adhere to that one level of safety standard, or the product doesn't ship. That's why these are de facto standards, because our products ship without that kind of quality assurance. And so this becomes a real curious question to me, which is, where is it appropriate to compete in the implementation world? So why don't we move to that, folks?
I mean, I'd really like to see browsers not competing on standards. I mean, I think standards should just be accepted, as Molly's kind of alluded to. I'd like to see them competing over browser features, over security, obviously, is a major issue. You know, tab browsing was a big, you know, big thing that everybody wanted. So I think that you know, those are the areas I'd like to see the innovation coming from browsers and the competition coming. I'd rather see us actually get to a kind of a baseline point with browsers where, you know, every browser is supporting, you know, CSS 2.1, or at least agreeing on certain aspects of 2.1 that are going to be universally implemented. So from a developer perspective, we don't have to worry about, you know, whether something's going to work in one browser versus another browser, and get that stuff taken care of before, you know, people start applying bits and other bits of CSS 3 and stuff like that, because that stuff, you know, that's where you're starting to compete
on
standards.
Well, Aaron, you know, I've actually said that to people, and they said, yeah, but you're going to stop innovation if you do that.
I don't think it stops innovation. I mean, I think the reason that we have all the innovation that we do on the web right now, especially in the JavaScript world, which is where I've spent a lot of my time, is because we have the firm foundation of standards. I think, you know, without that solid baseline, we would not be able to be where we are, because I'm sure most of you remember the really, really dark days of DHTML and having to write JavaScript for documents that, you know, weren't even well formed. It was abysmal, and you ended up with lots of code forking, which ended up to come back and fork us in the end. But it wasn't fun, and I think writing, that was why I hated JavaScript for a number of years, and then I started to come back to it once I realized that I had this nice foundation of rich semantic meaning in our documents, and it was no longer as painful. And I think, you know, that actually fuels innovation and allows us to create more and more interesting stuff on the web. I don't think we'd be where we are today with regard to Web 2.0, whatever that is, if it wasn't for a nice solid foundation of web standards.
I think what we need to understand in that conversation, the keyword innovation, what are we trying to innovate? Are we looking at just innovating the platforms? Sorry, it doesn't like the letter P. See? The innovation, what are we innovating on? Are we looking at just simply trying to evolve the platforms? Or are we here to facilitate the rest of the information or the knowledge base of the world? Because if we're thinking in terms of being stuck on innovation just on the platforms, I think we're being a little short-sighted. I think we forget our role in that we are trying to build technology so that everybody can have access to information.
I think that's very true, and again, but there seems to be a misperception. Please, if anybody has a different opinion, let me know. But a misperception that says that standards inhibit innovation, and yet it seems to me that with the web, that is at this point in history, at least, very untrue. That the adherence to the specification gives us the strength of platform that Aaron is alluding to in order to be able to innovate beyond the limitations of that platform. Anybody further comments there, Stephanie?
Well, I have a quick comment. I kind of agree with the fact that I don't think standards prohibit innovation, because, I mean, I don't know how many people out there work with CSS every day, but there's a lot of times where I have to kind of pull back a little bit on what I might want to do in a design, because I know it might not work in a certain browser. So I think the lack of standards, a lack of a baseline, like Aaron was talking about, causes me to, all right, well, I can't exactly do what I want here, so I'll just go back to this, you know, typical design and not try to innovate any further. So that's kind of what I run into every day.
So a limitation of not being able to push the envelope because of inconsistent implementations.
Right.
No fighting over that microphone.
From my background in large corporations that are very old, mostly they're not trying to innovate on the web. The web isn't their core product. It isn't the core way they interact with people. But they just see it as another channel to get to their customers. And pretty much all they want to do to be able to do is take all those, all that data that's, you know, on these, what previously was accessed as character-based UI and was programmed in COBOL, and push all that stuff out in through web applications so that people can use them. And basically, they're just trying to keep their another channel open to their customers. They're not trying to innovate specifically for the web.
But don't you see eventually that that's gonna, can't they see that eventually that's gonna come to a halt and not be able to serve them beyond a certain period of growth?
No. yeah, I mean, I think they do see it to some extent now, but when they started, basically it was, hey, let's go use that web thing. And we can probably make if we can make money on it, we can go do that. But as far as innovation goes, they're just looking to get the data to people so that they can make decisions, so they can pay their bills, so they can buy insurance.
Right. So they're not in it for the love of what they're doing or the passion of moving the technology forward. That's not their primary goal.
Absolutely.
How do you feel fitting into a circumstance like that as a person who is a vocal, activist or actively vocal, certainly within the usability community, how that makes you feel? I mean, what can you advocate? What can you do to help people understand that the way things are going via what we know from the W3C, via what we know from these specifications, how this can enable them and not keep them disabled by that?
So I have to talk in terms of if we code this differently, the page weight will be less. So you'll be serving up faster web pages, which will make your customers happy. You'll be sending less data over the web. And I know at this point that's not a big deal between a 30K and a 50K page for a lot of people, at least in the US. But you know, it adds up over time and it costs money, and that's how I frame the discussions with these people is, how can I save you money and how can I make you money? And when I start talking in terms of money, I think that's when they start listening.
Interesting. Yeah, that is, I've experienced that as well, and I imagine other people here have too, that especially in the education process with companies where they want the ROI. You know, the people on the ground are always excited to learn. They love the technology. They want to learn. They want to understand the specs better. They want to understand how to do their jobs better and make life easier on themselves, certainly. But I think what happens is they begin to, it's interesting because I think there's a cultural shift, as I was saying in the opening remarks, where now it's coming from the bottom up, whereas, again, when the web touches something, it inevitably changes, it forces a paradigmatic shift. And it seems like where we were coming from the top down in the hierarchy of business and organization, now there seems to be a bottom-up kind of phenomenon occurring where the people on the ground, bottom level, are having to fight their way through the ceiling to get what they need to keep the companies running. So it's a fascinating and very difficult, I think, a problem in the industry that you know, certainly W3C, it's a good place to be talking about this because it really relates to what I believe is that gap between the articulation of what we have as technology and how that really works in the world. Any other further comments on this question? Okay. Yes, good, yeah.
I'll jump in really quickly. I actually had a conversation with Alex Russell, who is the creator of the Dojo Toolkit. He actually did a really interesting session at the Rich Web Experience earlier this year, I believe it was in September. And it was called The Standards Heresy. And he used to be a standards advocate, now he considers himself a heretic. And the reason he considers himself a heretic is because he feels like the innovation is not there from the web standards community. He's basically put together the timeline of when things have happened within, let's say, the CSS spec and stuff like that, and is very disheartened by the massive gaps. But my point to him, and you know, some of you may disagree with me philosophically on this, but the tools are there within the spec to enable innovation by outside people. So if the Dojo Toolkit wants to, you know, innovate and add an element or something like that, add an attribute to the page, they can go ahead and do that using XHTML because it's extensible. That's the point. Same thing goes with CSS. If people want to put in CSS properties that are not part of the standard, there is a means of doing that using the initial hyphen and then the extensions within CSS. So you can do that, and then you could pick up that sort of stuff with JavaScript and do whatever you want with it, but there are means of doing that. And if it ends up being something that works, something that people actually want to use, maybe that ends up coming back full circle to the W3C and ends up being put into the spec, and that's a way to drive innovation from the outside. And innovation not necessarily just coming from a browser vendor, but from somebody who's actually in the community and that is interested in creating new widgets or what have you, we can actually do that sort of thing.
Great. Yeah, that's a very interesting, Alex Russell has an interesting take on that heresy thing. So that kind of relates, I think, what Alex has written about relates very strongly to this next question, which is process in the W3C. And I think that as we're all sitting here today, we realize that there is definitely a shift occurring in the way that we work. We see through the HTML, the phenomenon that's occurred with the HTML and XHTML groups, how there's an HTML5 working group now and how that is emerging, and it's open and it's transparent and anybody can become involved. So you have a real shift there about how a working group is handled. And I think that, improvements are already in place, but there has been, from the community in general, a lot of difficulty when specs are not, it's like the specifications and the implementations are completely out of sync with each other. So we're sitting on CSS 2.0 right now. 2.1 is in candidate recommendation. And so what do browsers do? You know, do they do draconian error handling according to CSS 2.0? Do they, follow 2.1 at this point? It's a very, do they start adding stuff with CSS 3? It becomes a very difficult, from an implementation standpoint, as well as a front-end development standpoint, it becomes a very difficult question. So one of the things that we discussed is how the process can be improved. And certainly I'm a strong advocate of opening up the process as much as possible. But of course, even in that environment, there has to be some kind of moderation and control. So let's open that up for some discussion, how that might go.
I'll start on this one. Yeah. I actually do think there is a fair amount of openness in the process. It's just not very well communicated. And so the perception, when maybe two or three people may represent the talking voice of a particular standard or specs, the notion is, where are the other people? Where do we start speaking? Where can we start speaking? There's information, but it is hard to find, and unless you already know how the process works, which is, it is not unreasonable or insensible. Perhaps the timeline needs to be faster to cater for the faster moving corporate world, but it is mostly that, I think, the communication problem here we have there.
I think that's a huge, it seems to keep coming back down to the articulation, the communication, the ability to, the outreach, the education and outreach piece has always been, and I think that there might be a historical, I'm sure people here at the W3C can clarify this, but that there's been a historical issue there that the W3C may not have been prepared or interested at the point of its emergence in doing that outreach, that other groups like the Web Standards Project or other educationally related groups would take on that role of bringing that information to the masses. So, the problem is that it hasn't really worked. If we look out, you just surf anywhere right now, you're all online, surf to a website that you've never been to before and view source. And how many people are really gonna see a valid page that's written, that's accessible, that is following and adhering to the best practices that we so strongly believe in, right? And I think that this is, it's really not infiltrated or seeped into the community as much and as fast as we need it to. So I think that articulation is a key piece.
I think one thing I've been, for some of you that weren't there, I've been sitting actually in the CSS working group for the last 2 days. And one of the things I thought was really interesting that was brought up the first day is that the working group is not marketing. Essentially, their strong suit is not marketing the spec, it's writing the spec. And you essentially rely on us, the authors, the educators, the bloggers, to essentially market for you, and organizations like WASP to advocate on your behalf. And I just think it's a really interesting thing. And it's kind of a conundrum, like how do a bunch of technical people from an academic background, deal with kind of shopping their wares around, I guess, like, hey, check out this cool thing that we're working on. And there really hasn't been a whole lot of communication with the outside world in terms of, you know, what's going on, what developments are taking place, what things are getting finalized. But I think I'm encouraged because I see that stuff starting to change. I think there are people who are starting to try and, you know, push the working groups a little bit further to open up, probably modeled a bit on what's happened with the What Working Group and such. And that's encouraging. I think that, you know, trying to, like, having the CSS Working Group blog and that sort of thing has been really encouraging. And we were talking about a lot of ways to try and bring in communications from outside of that particular core group to actually start having more of a conversation with the development community and how they want to implement some of this stuff, which I think is really good.
I have something to add, and I think it's, I'm not sure whether it's work, but it's more of a suggestion. I'm not sure it belongs to this question or later. In terms of process, I mean, in software development, which we've been, you know, we've got about 30, 40 years of history there, and we've learned our lessons, and often in the more flexible, interactive world these days, as we call it, we say that the waterfall model does not work. It's too slow.
The waterfall model doesn't work.
And so what you have is a new wave of developers trying out the more agile methodology, and what it means is you set your goals to be more short-term, and I've had the privilege of working on such a project whereby we list down the tasks for the week, and week by week we review, and that way you end up not trying to create a perfect product out of the box, but you evolve towards a perfect product, and that is sometimes a frustrating process because it seems to never end. But at the same time, it means that your team and your people have a constant sense of fulfillment week by week and saying, hey, you know, we've done something this week.
It's iterative, yeah.
And is more iterative, is more responsive, and if circumstances outside change, for example, if the needs change, you have the means to adapt because you have not planned out all your phases 3 months ahead.
And I think one of the interesting things about W3C process is that there's a frustration in that it seemingly, or at least the perception, people in the wild, as you know, the bloggers out there, will tell you, you know, what the heck is going on? You know, CSS 2.0, CSS 2.1. When are we ever going to get CSS 2.1? Will we ever see these things? They begin to doubt, right, very seriously, because of the lack, perhaps, of agility. That exists in the process. But of course, the other side of that argument is that the process was written in such a way as to ensure that everybody gets their say, which is a democratic view. So there's got to be some way, I think, to mitigate that. I don't know that any of us have the answers, but certainly taking a look at the issue is a good place to start. Any other comments or ideas on that? I really am a strong advocate of the agile process. Evolution and the process of that. So I think that, you know, bringing those kinds of ideas to working groups could be very effective.
I think at the end of the day, it's more like we're all humans, right? Yeah. We have to give ourselves that leverage of, you know, make ourselves feel good about it.
That's right. Very true.
I think one of the things that's kind of interesting to me, and obviously I'm speaking from the outside and from having observed the CSS working group the last 2 days, I think there's a real question within at least that working group and probably some of the other working groups as to, you know, where should innovation be driving and what is the general vision? You know, where is it that we want to go? And a lot of times, you know, different working groups don't necessarily take the pulse of the development community at large, and with that you kind of run the risk of kind of devolving into just academic exercises, which then become not very useful to the development community as a whole. And I think that that's kind of a trap to watch out for, and it's really important to kind of get a sense of vision, or at least every now and then kind of, you know, run a question out there and say, hey, what do you guys want to see? What are the pain points, and how can we make your lives easier?
Yeah, I definitely think that that's something that talking about with various members of the W3C, Ian and myself have had that conversation, and I know been talking to a lot of members of the community, so I'd like to see more of that, certainly, because that really begins, you know, take the temperature of the working world, take it before, you know, each sense of progress is made, and I think that would be very helpful as well. Test cases, you know, use cases, let's have some real stuff.
Yeah, I think use cases more so than test cases, mm-hmm. even.
Well, definitely. Test cases, I think, for the implementers more than anything, and use cases for how this is really going to be used. And we see that in the working groups themselves. We're challenged by that all the time. So it's an interesting thing. So I think that, you know, overall, to wrap that particular question up, I think that there's a, a perception among the working web designers who are at least paying attention to what's going on at the W3C, and unfortunately many are not, but the ones that are, you know, seeing that there is a shift in process and that that's a good thing. And I think that, you know, again, bringing those, the perception of the towers down. I'm not saying that this is an ivory tower, I'm saying that it is perceived as one by the community at large. You know, a closed group that has not been transparent. That is the perception, by and large. And so changing that perception is a very important first step. So one thing that, you know, consistently bothers me when I'm doing test cases or use cases is that I come up across, you know, a great example of this is error handling. I come across browsers in implementation, you know, defaulting to whichever spec they're following or choosing their own way of handling an error so that different browsers will get different results for a given error. And one of the problems with this is that as people working on the web, because there's a lack of education and consistent education, and there are many gaps in their knowledge, what happens is the working web developer designer begins to get highly frustrated because he or she is seeing results that are inconsistent, and they begin to blame the technology, they blame the W3C, they blame the browser, they blame themselves, you know, when the fact of the matter is that there is a fundamental lack of coordination that is nobody's fault. It's just the nature of an evolutionary and revolutionary technology. So how can we create some common goals and consistent priorities, do you think?
Speaking from a usability perspective, again, I watch people try and do things on the web quite a bit, and when they can't do something or they don't understand something, they don't blame the W3C, they don't blame the technology, they blame themselves, and they feel stupid.
Yep.
And so it's hopefully my job to make them feel empowered and not stupid, but a lot of that is outside of my control and also outside of my influence because of just of the realm that I work in. And I would like to see, you know, common goals and consistent priorities as well to help the end user get through their day without feeling like an idiot.
I completely
sit there. And I mean, if anyone's ever seen a usability test or been involved with one, the participant just begins to loathe themselves for something that either the UI isn't doing or the browser is incapable of doing or is inconsistent in how it communicates. And it's I feel bad when that happens. So
I think one thing that's interesting to think about is how much time we as developers spend trying to get the CSS to work consistently across all the browsers and how that time could be put to better use actually doing usability tests to make sure that our interfaces actually work for people so they don't feel stupid when they're using our websites. I think that, you know, that would be a good trade-off if we could kind of get browsers on a baseline and we know we have fairly consistent results across browsers, then we can focus on making the experience much better.
Yeah, I think that's a very strong point, and a key issue that I believe is really missing is that there's no consistency in test cases. I was and use cases in this regard. I saw something very interesting. I was over in London, and I was visiting Dean Edwards. Some of you might be familiar with him. He's a very fine JavaScripter, and he's part of the What Working Group. And I was looking at a project that he was working on, and it may be the only use of frames I'd ever seen that really made sense to me. But what he had done in this interface is he was working on a specification for a JavaScript library, and on the left-hand frame of the interface, he had all of the spec detailed. And in the right-hand frame, in accordance to everything that was detailed, was the actual rendering and behavior. And to me, that was like, wow, what if we did that with specifications, where suddenly you have not just the wording, but you actually see the way that the implementers should be implementing it. And that was kind of a revelation to me, that we don't really have that intermediary step where everybody is sitting down, perhaps outside of the W3C, and saying, okay, now that we've got these specifications, how are we going to handle some of the ambiguities that exist? How are we going to deal with error handling? How are we going to make things more consistent? So, I mean, I think it's not only a flaw in software development, but as people have pointed out here, this causes pain in the world. And so how do we help alleviate that pain? And that puts us, I think, in a better position if we can begin addressing that.
Just very quickly, you mentioned something about error handling.
Error handling, yes.
And how there are different ways browsers do it differently, and sometimes just make up something. I've heard many times, and I've actually heard this sentence said, it's a standard that we've adopted to fit our needs, which means it's not a standard. But they still consider it, you know, oh, we're following the standard. We've just tweaked it a little bit to meet what we're trying to accomplish. And, you know, maybe they are an edge case in that sense, but
they sort of hack the standard.
Potentially not, because, you know, there's the use case. Do we know what all the use cases are? Maybe this isn't an outlier. Maybe this is something that really needs to be bubbled up.
I think it does. And this came about, we had a conversation in Paris at X-Tech in April, and there were a lot of W3C folks there, and Opera Software, and Microsoft, and number of people, and we were having an open discussion, and Nokia was there, and they were talking about how they do third-party testing in the wireless community, and that was a very interesting model, something that perhaps, you know, should be looked at more explicitly by the W3C, is how to get, you know, some consistency on those baselines. And the last question that we are going to look at today is, how do we address, finally, what all this comes down to, of course, is the critical challenge of outreach and education. As Aaron pointedly said, the W3C is not a marketing facility, right? It is meant to, as an organization, to create specs. But it also has the ideology of moving the web forward. So if that's part of our call to action, how do we, as the people that are working in the side of education and outreach, how do we get empowered? So I'd like to take a look at that issue as well to wrap up the session. Any comments on that? Pat, why don't you get us started? Looks like you've been taking some notes there.
I have been taking some notes. Well, one thing I want to mention is, coming from the university background, I've been working in a university setting for just over 4 years now. And most universities are very decentralized, so it's hard to get different departments, different schools to actually talk to each other. And when it's difficult for the university, university-wide to talk to each other, and you have things like specifications that people can't decide on, or they're tough to read, it's even harder for all of these different groups to decide, all right, how should we implement a standard across all of our websites? These groups don't talk to each other in the first place, so it just makes things a lot more difficult, I find.
Aaron, you've been involved in a great deal of training and education.
I think, and I'll say this from the WASP perspective as well, I think the W3C and WASP as kind of an advocacy arm for the W3C is suffering right now from a crisis of relevance. The web development community at large is just somewhat dissatisfied with the, you know, I would say seemingly glacial pace at which the CSS spec has been moving and some of the other specs have been moving. Which I say seemingly because I know there has been progress, but it hasn't always bubbled up and been apparent to the community at large. And I think that there are ways, as I talked about the CSS working group starting to do more with blogging about what's going on. Certainly a lot of the working groups kind of taking keys from the What Working Group, et cetera, with being a little bit more open. I think those are all good steps towards doing this. And I'm really encouraged by the fact that the CSS Working Group is really interested in working with organizations, even ad hoc organizations like the CSS 11, who are essentially trying to ferret out ambiguities and actually provide use cases for the various CSS 3 specs, such as multi-call and advanced layout, that sort of thing. I think that's all very, very good, and I'd like to see more of that and to see more of a conversation. It's good to see some of the lists opening up and some communication with the outside world, and I think the more of that we can have, the better, certainly.
So I think, was there a final comment or Stephanie?
I'd actually have one comment, because there's a question that came on the RSE channel that fascinated me, and I think we should talk about it.
Okay.
It's about whether specifications have to be at a particular level for people to understand. Do you have to have a level of technical competency before you're supposed to understand a specification? And it fascinates me, because I think that has been a failure point for us. And from the very start of this session, we were talking about nomenclature and vocabulary. It is not necessarily about some, Molly, you have power problems. I don't think it's necessarily about whether someone is at a competency level to understand what you're writing. I think it is being able to break the information down so that all the different audiences involved in making a specification happen, that includes the web developers, the browser makers, for everybody to be able to understand that information and dispel it, and also be able to pass the information on. And I think that if people believe in the things you're doing, they will, you know, chime for you and cheer for you. So that's all I have to add.
I also think there's another problem that I'm just going to touch on, and I think that the tag group is probably, I'm not sure if it's meant to be this in this role, but there certainly seems to be a lack of continuity between various specs. So, for example, we were talking in the CSS meeting about again nomenclature and vocabulary. And how we wanted to stay as consistent with nomenclature, let's say in SVG, right? There's the ideology that we want to keep things as intuitive and consistent as possible. And I think that, you know, there doesn't seem to be any real overarching group that kind of does. I mean, there was the quality assurance group, and that's gone. So, you know, it seems like there's got to be something in there that's really sort of making sure that all of the working groups are working not just on their own and not just based on invitation for solving particular problems, but just in general more cohesive and collective. So that's one of the things that comes to my mind. And anyway, we have a couple of pathways to success here, and this is to wrap up and then we'll open to Q&A. Create common baselines. This would be a very good exercise. We have to clarify those ambiguities within specifications in order to make them more articulate, more accessible, if you will, to the people that are doing implementation as well as design and development. Transparent development cycles. This can help with the agile and open process and give people a better sense, I think, of when and where to begin implementing or begin pushing the envelope in design, for example, when you can begin to innovate beyond a certain point. And of course, keeping an open dialogue with the community. Let's keep this conversation going. This is a conversation that has to continue and in public. And of course, fostering events and networking, I highly encourage that as a definite way. One of the things that I often say within companies or groups is to encourage, you know, the brown bag lunch, teach each other what you know, all of that. And finally, compete on the user interface and features, but not on the standards. I'd like to open for Q&A at this point in time.
I have a couple of questions from IRC, actually.
Okay,
I've been,
great. Why don't
been keeping
we,
tags
why don't
on them.
And then please, if you'd like to come up and ask questions, there are microphones to the left and right. Huh?
And if you don't want to come up to the microphone because you don't like the sound of your voice like I don't over microphones, you can feel free to send it directly to me on the IRC chat. So the first question I have is, how much developer designer frustration around CSS and XHTML is related to implementations not keeping up with the standards, and how much is with the actual spec?
Ooh. Okay, read it again.
Okay. How much of the frustration is due to the spec, or and how much is due to the implementations not actually keeping up with the spec?
Yes.
Definitely. A lot.
So from my background, it's the implementation. I would be suspect if anyone I've worked with in the past 10 years has read a spec. I mean, they may have, but
They may have tried.
Yeah.
We have an anxious hand waver here.
Yes.
Have we said thanks to these folks for coming first?
Thank you.
Hi, Dan Connolly here. This is sort of
near
and dear to my heart. I think we can all do a better job of managing expectations around CSS and HTML and stuff like that. I think pointing fingers is not the way to start. Except pointing fingers here at me. I'm co-chairing the HTML working group with Chris Wilson of Microsoft, and that's what we're going to try to do. We're certainly going to have a conversation on Saturday about. Ian Hixey has been blogging about how this is a 20-year effort. I've been saying I'm out of here in 18 months. So we're going to have that.
Later, you wonder what the heck happened.
We're going to have that conversation, absolutely. The standards organizations are about about making the progress predictable in a certain way. That companies want to have early access to the change, and they want manageable change, and the users want to have, you know, a rallying thing that they can, they're willing to wait for a certain amount of time, but not too much time, and you can renegotiate expectations and things like that. So yeah, that's all very, you know, near and dear to my heart. The other thing is storytelling and test cases. You said use cases and test cases. This is my plug for my lightning talk. I guess there'll be some kind of voting mechanism later, so.
A little self-promotion there, Dan? No, just kidding. Anyway, Dan, I want to point out very strongly to everybody here as well that this is not if there's criticism in this conversation, it's meant to be constructive. We are not here to be battling. We are here to be working together. So that is ultimately the final message, right? So hopefully, if you're hearing some negativity, it's not that we are ourselves negative. It's that we are representing a frustrated group of people, truly frustrated group of people.
And if things change, we'll all benefit, yeah, really.
Exactly. So there's some IRC. We have David Barron. We have Halkin. We have a couple people here. So let's do an IRC question and then maybe go to David.
All right. So also the words web standards to the larger web development world is shorthand for the hacks I have to use to get around things in IE6. Is it the standards themselves that have failed or the education around them?
Yes.
God has spoken.
I think that yes, it's both of those things. That you know, clearly there's problems in the process, ambiguities in the specifications, the time frame issues, as well as the fact that there's, again, we speak to this issue of not that there being this huge gap in education. There are really nightmarish stories out there of people who, you know, end up in college and they're taking a class in web design and the instructor is teaching them how to use Dreamweaver, and the first thing the instructor does is say, okay, you know, file new, insert table, and begins teaching them. And there was actually a case where a university student, a woman, had been doing studying in standards and developed the web for the course, had to develop a website. She wrote the website in accordance with standards and best practices as we see them today with XHTML and CSS and good JavaScript, and guess what? She failed the course because she didn't adhere to the fact that she was supposed to build the site in tables, and the instructor had no idea of what the CSS was. So these stories exist, I know. It's horrifying, is it not? It's absolutely horrifying. So we have a situation in education that is very, very serious. And until we are able to improve that these problems are going to continue on the ground level, which is no fault of anybody except the process of taking evolving technology and teaching it to people. It's a hard time.
Yeah, unfortunately, a lot of universities and even high schools that have classes and stuff like that now, you know, they're teaching tools, they're not teaching technologies, and that's a major problem. And I always think of the story that Molly tells sometimes about not knowing what's going on under the hood, about driving through the desert and driving really fast with the top down and stuff like that, and then all of a sudden her car overheats and she opens up the hood and has no idea what's going on with the car and no idea how to fix it, so pretty soon she's going to become buzzard food.
Telling my anecdotes.
So it's a good little analogy for the fact that, you know, people who spend so much of their time in Dreamweaver trying to laying out stuff in tables and things like that, when all of a sudden something goes wrong, they have no clue what exactly they need to do in order to fix it, and that ends up again costing the business more money for development time and that sort of thing. And it all comes down to, you know, people teaching specifically to tools as opposed to teaching to technologies. And a lot of that probably comes down to the fact that it's really hard to teach these technologies because at this point there's so many hoops that you have to jump through. And yeah, over time you start to know what they are. And yeah, you know, my conditionally commented style sheets for IE6 are a lot smaller now than they were, you know, even 2 years ago. But, you know, it all comes from knowing what the problems are and knowing how to avoid them a little bit easier. But we don't have that in education yet because it's not easy to teach.
I'd like to go to David, please. Thanks, Aaron.
Hi, David Barron. Mozilla. I want to take issue with the statement you made that we shouldn't compete on standards. And I think the fundamental, in one sentence, the fundamental problem with that is who decides on the list of standards that we don't compete on?
Well, this is a good question, but when you walk out of the...
Go ahead,
I'm sorry.
So, for example, there's a lot of people in this room. Not all that many of them work on CSS. I mean, so are you saying that the list, that every web browser should implement HTML and XHTML and all the DOM specs, all the CSS specs, SVG, XForms, XSLFO, XSLTX, PointerX, include SOAP, Whistle, Smile.
I got it. Okay, so David, so, what I think is that we have to prioritize, as we always have to prioritize, the tools, the technologies that people are really using in the real world. Okay, when you're working at a bank, you know, and you're trying to provide a secure and workable website or build applications that adhere to certain specifications and standards within your organization, having your toolkit, you have to go by what the priorities are in the world rather than what the priorities might be. This doesn't mean stop researching and stop evolving some of those technologies, but it means put focus and emphasis on what is needed now and what people are asking for. So I think you make a good point, which standards, right? And that's a very fair point. Clearly, we're front-end developers and designers for the most part, and that's obviously the bias that we're going to have. But these are the people that are having the most difficult time out there, I think, at this point in history. And that's why this conversation is taking place.
I have an ugly story to tell. In the marketing world, if you like, and I know that for the most part here, it's probably not something that everyone up here is interested in, but it happens a lot, and there's a lot of advertising, there's a lot of revenue generated there, and that's why it's interesting to most companies with the cash. Their idea of sending messages to other people about their products, one with the highest yield is via email, well, for want of a better word, email campaign. I think you know what I mean. And because all email systems or whatever, what have you, all the clients process HTML differently, we are resorted to using very, very bad code, about 3 levels of tables, in order to have a rich graphic experience that clients expect to pay for. And that completely almost undermines what we've been all fighting for here. And I think that's distressing because I can tell you, roughly how many email campaigns we are expected to send out a day, and that's a lot of bad code.
I completely agree, and I think there's a further thing here to David's question, which is really it's a chicken and the egg situation. You know, do you implement something that is a standard because, you know, you imagine people are going to use it, or do you wait for people to start trying to use it before you implement it in the browser, and it becomes a problem? But that's where use cases, as opposed to test cases, really come in. You know, what are the uses of this particular technology, and getting that sort of input from the outside community, and then making some sort of judgment. Obviously, there has to be some group that decides, you know, what are the most important things. You know, 10 people rallying really hard around one particular thing versus, you know, 2,000 people or 5,000 people that really want something else, you kind of have to make those judgments and make some decisions as to what the use cases are and how much weight to give each of them. But I think that's a good place to start to kind of get beyond that chicken and the egg scenario.
David, it looks like you have a follow-up, but we only have a couple of minutes. Yeah, Håkon?
Håkon Lee, Opera Software. I think a lot of the frustration that's been vented, both in questions and answers here, could be have been avoided if browsers had actually implemented standards early on. CSS2 from 1998, for example, had CSS tables, which would have made it very much easier to display content the way authors want without resorting to table markup. Now, that didn't happen, and there are many reasons for that. But I think if browsers were better, we wouldn't have all the frustration with the specs don't match the implementations, and you look stupid when you test because the test doesn't come out the way you expect to. So improving browser quality is very important, and I think one way of doing that is testing and writing one specific kind of test. The ACID2 test has been developed. Many people know it probably here. It's developed as one web page. It's very hard to render that page, but once it's rendered, you get a smiley face on your screen. And over the last year, it's been amazing. We've seen all major browser, with one exception, now passes the ACID2 test with pixel perfection. And that means designers can go to a whole new world with the kind of designs they want to achieve. And I think other specs should do the same kind of thing. Have not, you know, it's good to have hundreds of tests too. That's fine, do it. But have one ACID test for each spec.
So, okay, being involved in the ACID2 test with you. One of the things that I would like to suggest in the future is that should we be doing future ACID tests of that nature, they should be done collaboratively and not just by a small group of people from one company. That would be my suggestion for the future. Thank
Absolutely.
You. Thank you.
This should be a community effort,
yes.
Too.
Thank you, Håkon. I'm very glad to hear you say that. Awesome. Thank you.
Ann Bassetti, Boeing. Well, I always bring the mantra of the problems of the big corporate world, and I see my colleague Roger Cutler here from Chevron, who echoes the same message. You know, we have 150,000 desktops. This is an immense problem to deal with. We just cannot be upgrading our browser every time something new comes out. We cannot deal with plugins and extensions. We need native support of basic standards in the browser. And of course, the question that David Barron raised is which standards? Well, maybe the acid test that Håkon just talked about is a good way to go to sort of determine a collective vision in that regard. But we cannot tolerate vendors who are elaborating and inventing in the browser. The whole point of the web, the whole benefit of the web to us is the ability to put content in one place and everybody in the company can read it regardless which kind of platform they're on or which browser they're using. It's just immensely important to us that be able to occur. And we have something estimated between 10 and 20 million pages inside Boeing. We can't rewrite content every time some new browser thing comes out. We just can't do it, period. My colleague Scott is here. If you want to meet him, I'll introduce you. He handles all the browsers in the company, and he's the one who's left to resolve the problems when that happens. And it's just an immense time waste.
I'm sorry, because we're running very, very out of time, but not to cut you off at a very important point, but to cut you off at a very important point.
Yes.
We are continuing the conversation, as I mentioned earlier, please, because I know that a lot of people are very concerned about these relationships. So please bring your colleague, let's sit down. We have a half hour of break, and then we also have lunch. And these kinds of things can be more explicitly discussed, because I can see Ian back there ready to take the mic, and we need to move things forward. So
I just want to say that developers need better training. We've talked about that a lot. And you guys might be worrying about the latest thing in CSS. Our poor folks barely have gotten to CSS 1, you know. Yeah. So, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Hello. Ian Jacobs, head of communications for W3C. And I'm going to tell you how it's going to be now.
Ooh.
No, that's the.
Ooh.
No, I actually wanted to thank you all first for coming. This panel is part of discussions that we started too late, but we're happy to finally get underway. Even a year and a half ago or so, we've had a bunch of very valuable conversations with a lot of people now. And I'm very happy to say that we're already working on a site redesign. We are talking more and more with developers. We are talking about a W3C blog and getting more and more communities involved in W3C. I think this is one of the only ways that we can scale, for example, in the area of outreach and education. We can't do it ourselves. There's a lot of great material out there. I've been talking to the W3 schools folks, for example, and everywhere where there seems to be good content, we want to engage with those people more and more. So please come talk to me, because I don't have all the answers at all, and I would love to hear from all of you how we can get this done. Thanks.
Well, certainly on that note, on behalf of the panel and myself, we want to thank you all so very much for the hard work that you do every day, and thank you all for listening to our point of view. Thanks.
I would say grab us in the hall.
Is the queue closed?
So,
the queue's closed?
Closed.
Okay.
There'll be plenty of time to talk to these guys at the buff tables and out in the hallway too during the break, which is coming up next. I also want to make sure that people, even though we focused mainly on CSS and HTML and the difficulties there, I think there's a lot of lessons here that we can learn for the many other of our 60 groups out that are working in W3C in terms of thinking about the end user, trying to understand what their challenges are, and stepping way back from the mic so don't overdrive it. So please think about that too, about the things you heard and how this applies to your particular working groups as well. So we have a break. Sign up for the BOF tables on the outside here. And let's see. Any of you who are doing lightning talks or speaking next, please come up during the break and test get set up for the next group, but also test out your slides and so on and make sure those work fine. Okay, thanks again. Enjoy the break. Be back promptly at 10:30. Thanks.